Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
Tomato soup.
There are 14 varieties of tomato soup available from this replicator, with rice, with vegetables, bouillon style, with pasta, with...
Plain.
Specify hot or chilled.
Hot. Hot, plain tomato soup.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. My name is Barry, and I am here with my lovely co-host, Mr. Dan. How you doing today, Dan?
Not too bad. I've got a bit of a hunger on right now, and it has to do with what we've been writing in our outline for this episode, so I'm a little hungry.
You know what? To be honest with you, I am a very, very food-driven person, and I have more to talk about there. I'm not going to spoil it all just now, pun intended, I guess. definitely doing this episode has increased my desire to do all things culinary, and being a food-driven person, it's always fun to know that the characters we love in Star Trek also tend to be a little bit food- and drink-driven, and it really does actually apply a lot to their character. I'm actually blown away how much, in a sort of overt and covert way, food shows up in Star Trek. And being someone who loves talking about food and eating food and thinking about food, I think what better way to move into this episode by talking about all of the different types of food in Star Trek. And as usual, Dan, you and I in our little pre-conversation have found out that we would need 3 or 4 episodes to actually do this topic any real justice. This whole episode was sort of inspired by me finally trying to become a Voyager completionist and the realization that Neelix basically spends all of his time cooking in most of the episodes. And it's... You know, obviously it's kind of a sight of humor and everything else, but it got me thinking about, you know, obviously Klingons and their gross out fear factor food and the various different types of soup that shows up in Star Trek. My goodness, every alien seems to have their own form of like stew or soup or something like that. So without any further ado, I am excited to say that we are going to do our best to cover as much of all of the delicious culinary treats that you can get in the Star Trek universe and how much it actually reflects the characters and the species that those culinary treats belong to. Mm-hmm. So I guess, is there any type of food, just human food, that you would say is your favorite? Do you have a favorite food, Dan?
Oh, I mean, there are some standbys from childhood that, like my mom's shepherd's pie is just, it's so good. My dad, anything he cooks is amazing. He's someone that kind of actually reminds me, and we'll get to this, he reminds me of like Pike and Sisko, who are, you know, always experimenting and improving their craft in the kitchen. But I would also say overall, just from my experiences as an adult, Korean food. I love Korean food in almost all of its forms. I'm so glad we finally have a Korean restaurant where we live here in Grand Prairie. So, yeah.
Yeah. Have you been there yet?
I have, and they're pretty good. Ooh.
Okay. Well, and actually that's, I really want to try it too. I haven't been there yet.
It's a date.
We've been awesome. Okay, good. I'm going to hold you to that.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Yeah. For me, I was pretty lucky to grow up in a sweet spot in Edmonton where I had, a family I grew up with. The parents were Greek and French. And so they did, you know, French onion soup and spanakopita and all of these really cool different dishes. I tried escargot at a very young age, so that was pretty cool. And then I lived down the street from an Italian family as well. And then one of my mom's best friends was in an Italian family as well, married in. And I remember the salami that the patriarch of the family made was always quite the delicacy. But he wasn't a very friendly human being, to be honest. He was actually kind of a jerk, to the extent that he decided that nobody was worthy of his salami recipe. So it died with him. And I remember when we got our final bit of salami after he passed away, the family was crying and, you know, like, yeah, you know, it's sad to lose him. And they're like, just, you know, obviously, yes, it's sad to lose our grandfather, but also we're really sad because we know this is the last we're ever going to have this delicious salami.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, the recipe's gone. I've never had it again. So definitely. But I would say probably my favorite food, and it again kind of harkens back to a formative time in my life, is the Japanese dish chirashi, which is pretty simple. It's just a bunch of raw fish on a bed of rice, plated up quite nicely, but typically it'll be added with a little shiso leaf. Oh, it's a little green leaf that kind of tastes sweet, savory. I don't even know how to explain it. There's almost an astringency to it. But when you add the little slices, you just peel off little slices of the shiso leaf and you put it on, say, like the squid or any of the fish, it really does enhance the flavor quite a bit. Mm. And my mouth is watering now thinking about that. So, yeah, if you hear us going all the way through here, it's because, you know, food is good. I love food.
Absolutely, yeah.
So typically when people talk about Star Trek, I think often, and I was talking with a couple of other friends of mine who are in Edmonton, who are older Star Trek fans and people who actually, one of my friends who got me into Deep Space Nine, always really enjoy the gross out factor of Klingon food. And I think as Star Trek fans, we've got to start with the Klingons because Gah and Bloodwine especially tend to factor heavily when people think about alien food, because it's got to be sort of really off-putting. You know, there's the story that Gok actually doesn't taste good even to a Klingon. Why the Klingons like it is because the little worms actually are spasming and they're dying in their mouths and in their stomachs, and that's the that's the delicacy of Gok. And it's fun to watch how different Star Trek characters who aren't Klingon react, right? Picard has sort of stated, I think, in one of the episodes that he actually doesn't mind it. Riker, of course, is offered Klingon breast milk if he can't handle the taste of Gok and everything else when he does his little exchange mission on that Klingon bird of prey.
I do love the setup for that as well, just to kind of jump in here, because they already had the gross out factor at the beginning where he's trying all of these foods, but they take it up a notch, and that's the episode where they first introduced, oh no, it's best served live. You didn't realize this? And Riker is just like, yeah. Ugh.
So I think, you know, to some degree, this makes the Klingons what they are in a lot of ways. You can usually learn a lot about a society by what they eat. And I don't mean this in necessarily a negative way, but the Klingons represent that sort of ramped up, amped up, hyper macho form of humanity that, you know, is very violent and is very performative and theatrical. And what better way to eat something than to have it almost semi fight back? Thinking of Korean food, for instance, there are instances I have heard of where you do eat a live squid in a very awful way. I had a friend who lived in Korea as well, who was actually on a Korean game show where he had to eat, I think it was either an octopus or a squid, and it fought back. Like, mm-hmm. It was very much fighting back. And then I've had ikakarage, a type of Japanese squid. And because the squid is killed so recently from when it's breaded and deep fried, typically the little tentacles are still still moving around a little bit when you finally get the food. Mm-hmm. So again, not necessarily outside of the norm when it comes to the food that human beings would eat. But what do you think, Dan? Would you try gach?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that I've tried, but at the same time, like, they're not outside of the norm too much. Like, I guess if it really came down to it, I probably wouldn't, if I'm really being honest, because, you know, I've been on, you know, at street vendors in Thailand, and I did try the, like, fried big, huge cricket thing. But I did not try the fried tarantula. I just, like, there was some line there that I was like, nope, I'm not going to do that. So wriggling serpent worms, probably not going to try. I do love how much this meme has propagated through Star Trek since its inception, though. Like, and the more we learn, there's different, you know, there's different vintages of gach and different varieties of it as well. I remember a Deep Space Nine episode where Ezri Dax is talking about all these different types of gach, different varieties, and she's kind of recounting them. She's like, oh, this variety, you know, really wriggles on its way down. This other variety has tiny feet. And then she just kind of goes like, huh? And she's like, I gotta go. I love that.
You know, it gives you sort of the, basically, I like to link this idea of gach to Klingon opera, mm-hmm. right? When you think of Klingon opera, and you and I joke a lot about Melota, but if you actually hear that song, when it gets played, when Worf hears it, you know, it's all of these sort of dissonant noises, minor keys. It's a, you know, obviously it's a tragedy. It's from, you know, it's played from the losing side and all this sort of stuff. And again, you kind of get this macho, sacrificial, violent, very, very violent noises and stuff like that. When you live in that kind of dissonance, of course your food is going to replicate that. But what I do like isn't necessarily just how the Klingons revolt us. I really do actually appreciate how much they're revolted by our food.
Yes.
And you brought this up. I wasn't able to find the specific episode that it took place on, but I'll leave it to you to explain what Kern thinks about human food.
Yeah, well, the Klingon food, even beyond gach, is just kind of represented by, you know, not cooking it. It's live, it's hunted, it's just, you know, you eat it as it is kind of thing. And the idea of cooking food is burning food. Like, why would you do that? And yeah, it's the TNG episode Sins of the Father where we first meet Kern, and they serve a turkey dinner as like a welcome to the Enterprise because he's doing an officer exchange program. He hasn't revealed he's Worf's brother yet, but he's like, very well, I will try your burned replicated bird meat.
There we are. Yes. I was wondering if it was the Undiscovered Country or if it was some episode if that was mentioned, because I know they sit down to dinner in the Undiscovered Country as well. The idea that they don't like the idea that we burn our food or cook our food and stuff like that. So the idea that the feeling is mutual when food is something that grosses another person out. And I think that's often a thing, right? I took my mom many, many, many years ago when I was a teenager for my birthday. She was like, where do you want to go for your birthday? And I want to go for sushi. And I remember my mom just being very uncomfortable the entire time, seeing all of this raw fish and stuff. And to her, you know, it's just not a thing. But I think the best one was a friend of mine from childhood. He really did want to, like, honestly and earnestly try sushi for the first time. And I remember I chose salmon because I personally like salmon quite a bit. I like the taste of it. Salmon sushi is my personal favorite of the affordable types of sushi, because there are, you know, like otoro and stuff like that, like the belly of a tuna and whatnot, that are very, very tasty. But, you know, you kind of run into some expensive issues and some ethical issues, too, when you're consuming certain types of fish.
Yeah.
But I remember he placed the sushi in his mouth, the fish in his mouth, and kind of, you could tell he was really like wrestling with his own tongue to try to get that food down his throat. And eventually he just spit it out and he was like, I am so sorry. I just can't do this. I'm just like, you know, it's okay. Like to try different types of food, you know, where you say you've got a line where you just simply can't draw it. I think that's the best part about the Klingons is everything's a dare. Everything is an attempt to see what you're capable of doing. And if you're incapable of it, then perhaps you would prefer breast milk, ultimately, you know? So it's just, look at me. I'm a big dude. I can choke this stuff down and love it.
And I like your point too, from the other side as well. Like, I distinctly remember when I was working in Korea, and there were school lunches, right? There was food prepared for both the staff and the students every day. And every once in a while, they would have like a Western food day. Like, you'd walk into the little cafeteria and it'd be like, oh, it's like hot dogs or hamburgers or something like that. And invariably, and this was usually the older male teachers would walk in, take one look, turn around and walk back out and cook a little pot of ramyeon or ramen on their hot plate in their office. And they're like, oh, one of these days. Okay.
Yeah, this isn't happening.
No.
Yeah. I've often had to change my palate now too, with my family, nothing against them. And I'm not trying to throw them any shade, but I'm a big fan of spice. I love spicy food, like hot picante kind of stuff. When I went to Belize, a few students who were Belizean, their mother actually sent me several care packages of different variations of prepared habanero peppers.
Ooh, nice.
As sort of like a preparation. And she's like, you know, put this in your food, make sure it's, make sure it's in your food, and you'll be ready. And when the time came to go to Belize, I went on a little tour. This guy named Jose took friends of mine. We gave him, you know, a couple hundred American dollars, and he just drove us around Belize for a couple of days, which was wonderful and so much fun. But we stopped actually at the zoo. The zoo has a really good restaurant. If you're ever in Belize, it's really unassuming, looks like a cafeteria, but the food is absolutely amazing. I mean, this is almost 10-year-old information, so who knows what might have changed. Maybe it's better, maybe it's worse, I'm not sure, but I had the proper Belizean rice and beans to a Belizean level of spice. And I remember Jose saw me eating the food, and like, he raised an eyebrow, and I'm like, well, what do you think? And he's like, for a gringo, you're doing pretty good there, buddy. Like, I'm actually pretty impressed. But let me just put it this way, and I don't want to get too much into it. Remember, folks, if it's hot going in, it'll be hot coming out. And I had a really rough day the next day. I wasn't able to leave the hotel that we were staying. I wasn't able to get too far. I could get to the beach, and then I'd have to run back every now and again. So I think, you know, the idea that sometimes when you do manage to overcome the Klingon fear factor, shall we say, or manage to withstand the certain levels of resistance, sometimes there is a price to pay.
This is where, if we had a bigger budget, you know, the strains of Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire would start, you know, coming in the background here.
Yeah, well, I really fell into one. So maybe moving on to something a little more understated, the Romulan Vulcan cuisine I have found interesting as well. It seems like a very soup-heavy culture, both Romulans and Vulcans. The Plomeek soup seems to be the most loved, or at least, you know, the most spoken about, at least at the very start of the TNG world and everything else. One thing that I do find about it is the Vulcans especially, you know, really hammer down the idea that most of them are vegetarian. Most of them, you know, they eat logically. They don't eat for flavor or zest. But I always think about red spice. It was O'Brien's favorite stew, I think. Is it a stew or is it a soup? I wasn't able to really get the down low on that one, because it also shows up in Discovery in an episode 2, if I remember correctly, that red spice ends up coming up. And I did actually find a recipe, or at least something of a recipe for it, and it actually sounds quite tasty. What do you know of red spice, or would you want to talk more about the Plomeek that they eat in? I think it was Unification.
Yeah, well, I think Plomeek soup first comes in the TOS episode Amok Time. It's the soup that Christine Chapel prepares for Spock that he gets quite irate about, because she's not his woman and should not be preparing him soup.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but we'll just shuffle on by that. But yeah, I feel like, and this is kind of the real world coming in a little bit, I think it's easy to put water or colored water in a bowl and put it in front of an actor. And that scene in Unification, actually, there's a couple moments where I it seems to me pretty clear they're just like spooning water into their mouths, but
yeah,
if I'm remembering correctly. But yeah, so Red Spice, I remember, yeah, it was mentioned as being part of a stew in a Deep Space Nine episode like you're talking about here. I didn't catch the Discovery reference though. That's awesome. Yeah, in the episode Choose to Live, is according to Memory Alpha, President Tarina offers it to Book, offers him a warm Red Spice.
Yes, that was it. Exactly.
That almost sounds like a drink in that case, which is interesting. So according to this, Red Spice is the spice. So it's used in this broth of this stew, but maybe it's also used in drinks or something like that, like a tea or something like that.
Well, there's a Plomeek tea as well.
That's true.
I was able to find. So I think, you know, there's a certain versatility, but very water-based cuisine when it comes to Romulans and Vulcans. I wonder if they have very cast iron bladders for that reason. Because, you know, Spock and Picard, you know, they down a fair amount of soup in Unification, I gotta say.
Yeah. Definitely.
There is something to be said about a good soup, though. And mm-hmm. I actually learned a little while back how to make proper soup. I pride myself on having a couple copper pots and saucepans and frying pans and stuff like that. I was able to find at Canadian Tire once, there was this like crazy sale going on, and I was able to buy the display model for thousands of dollars, and I mean this, thousands of dollars less than what it should have been. It was a real impulse buy on my end. I spent more than I should have, but in the years that I've cooked since, especially when it comes to making soup, I've made a lot of sweet potato based soups, some vegetable soups, different types of tomato soup, and actually a couple of borschts as well, with the way a copper will sort of conduct heat in an even sort of way. You don't have to use a lot of energy. It holds the heat in, which allows the flavor really to come out. So I would consider myself pretty ready to try most Romulan and Vulcan cuisine because I am a very big soup fan.
Yeah, and soups do seem to be very ubiquitous, like at least in the cultures of Earth, right? Like I can't think of a culture that doesn't have some sort of soup or something like that. Other than maybe some like very nomadic cultures and stuff like that, because
potentially,
I guess it's a little harder to transport, but easy to make once you get somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, my favorite soup I ever had was in Mexico, where what they do is all of the ingredients are raw in the broth. And you are given a stone bowl that has been superheated. Like they tell you like 50 or 60 times not to touch it. And then they pour all of the ingredients in and it just explodes with flavor. It's very, very fragrant. And speaking of fragrant, I don't want to go too much off topic from the soup yet, but there was a species, and I'm trying to remember, who liked very fragrant food.
I don't know if it's the one you're thinking about there, but there is an Enterprise episode where they talk specifically the cogenitor species.
That was it.
The Visians, is it? And
yes.
Reed's introducing the one, you know, gorgeous young woman to a variety of cheeses that he feels are very pungent.
Yes, I remember that. There we are, cogenitor. That was the episode I was thinking, but for some reason I thought it was TNG for some reason. But yes, that was exactly the one where they said, we prefer our food to be more fragrant. Well, I remember when I had that soup in Mexico and it had different types of mollusks in it and whatnot, which again, I think would make a Vulcan or a Romulan very happy because mollusks really come up in their food too. I have noticed as well. It was very fragrant. Like it filled the entire restaurant with the smell. And I could tell like other patrons of the restaurant were like looking over being like, what is that? And it got ordered a few more times after I'd had it. It was a really cute little restaurant on the beach that had swings for chairs. So if you're ever sort of in the Tulum area, get off the beaten path, get off the resort, take a colectivo to that kind of beachway near the ruins of the old Tulum temple. And yeah, I can't remember exactly, but if you see a restaurant with swings instead of seats, that's the one. Ask for their soup and you will be in flavor country. I guarantee it.
That actually reminds me of a Korean dish, which it's kind of almost, and I mean, somebody in the comments who's listening is probably going to jump down my throat for this, but it It stinks. It's this fermented soybean paste stew.
Ooh, I've had that.
Denjang jjigae. And my pronunciation is terrible, by the way. But the smell when you walk into a room where it's being prepared, and there every once in a while there was a school lunch where that was being made. So great volumes of this stuff. And yeah. I'm just not used to the smell. So it's like you can't get it out of your sinuses. It just permeates everything.
And, or your clothes.
Yeah. And it's... stinks. It really stinks, in my opinion. Then you sit down to eat it, and it is so good. The cognitive dissonance of eating this and smelling it at the same time, it's kind of like durian in that way. But, oh, it is so good. It still confuses my brain to this day.
Well, that kind of reminds me of Bajoran hasperet, which sounds like different variants of cabbage, and they have different types of it. And I remember my Korean friend who I went to college with, I'd go to his house for his mom's amazing cooking. And I would argue that her japchae is probably the greatest noodle dish I've ever had in my entire life. Japchae is sort of like a savory glass noodle served warm or cold. And it is very, very good, sort of brown to the look, salty, but has a really nice kind of a tang to it. I find most Korean food has a really delightful tang, even to the smell as well, with the exception of that stew you just mentioned. But one thing I really loved about Hwan Suk is his name. His mom's, she made her own kimchi. Again, you know, she could burn your eyes cooking different types of kimchi in different ways. But all of the different variants that she was able to make, there was different types of kimchi with kind of more of like a smoky taste to it, almost like a mesquite. And then like traditional kimchi, which would have just been like a bean sprout rather than a cabbage with no chili, because they actually got the chili from Central America, is where Koreans end up getting the idea of putting chili in kimchi, which, of course, kimchi is a delightful superfood in my eyes. I mean, it's not actually a superfood, but I just find it does a lot to help digestion. It cleanses the palate really, really well. And honestly, I could just eat it with some rice and some seaweed. Honestly, kimchi is super versatile. Sometimes I like to put it in my ramyeon as well if I am having it. But I find the Bajoran hasperet kind of falls into that category of cabbage-based delights from an oppressed people. And of course, the Koreans were oppressed for an extremely long period of time by both the Chinese and the Japanese at different points in their history. So were Ukrainians. And what do you know? Cabbage shows up again quite a bit. So, you know, cabbage rolls especially kind of factor into my brain, different types of borscht and soups and stuff like that. And how something kind of so basic can be so versatile and ultimately gets used in a lot of different ways by the Bajorans in their hasperet soup. Of course, to the love or chagrin of different Star Trek characters who try it.
Well, I love like hasperet, just the hasperet by itself. The prop they used, interestingly, was a flour tortilla with cream cheese and cut up bell peppers, and you roll it up, and that's Bajoran hasperet. And then, yeah, later on we get hasperet souffle gets mentioned in one episode, and like you said, hasperet soup. And I'm interested how that translates from the tortilla form into that. That's interesting, but it's also reportedly very spicy.
Well, yeah, it really does kind of fall into the world of cabbage, I find, because cabbage is just so versatile, and I love cabbage. I mean, I don't want to. I never thought I'd be able to talk on a podcast about my love affair with cabbage, but I add cabbage to everything. I made tacos the other night for the family and cut up. Really diced finely some cabbage into that, shredded it. Basically, whenever I do a stir fry, I end up adding some bok choy or shui choy, depending, you know, I especially like Shanghai bok choy, the tiny little baby ones, or even a Napa cabbage is quite a nice addition. Of course, I love borscht as well. So I don't know. I think, you know, we talking a little bit more, actually, the last thing I want to talk about is when humans especially try making the alien cuisine, it's typically a disaster, right? I like to think of in Enterprise's Breaking the Ice when they make Poktar and the Vulcan designate doesn't even touch. He doesn't even touch it. He won't eat it. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of, I went on a really interesting hike once. We were in Yoho National Park, my venture group. I was in the Scouts and was one up from Scouts. We were in Ventures, and we had a couple of friends from India come over, and they did some hiking with us. And of course, they were from northern India, where, you know, the tallest mountains in the world are. And so they saw our mountains as cute, I think is the best way to put it. because, you know, we're huffing and puffing, and they're just like, come on, guys, let's go. You know, is that a bear? And like, just totally excited to be getting up this mountain. Actually, I ended up getting mild altitude sickness because we moved so fast to keep up with our Indian friends. So mad props to them. Well, man, I have to say, like, the physical ability of those people. And there was one gentleman by the name of Rajat who taught me a little bit of Punjabi as well, which was really cool, which I've promptly forgotten. But I remember he had never really tried much North American cuisine. It was his first time in Canada. And I remember we'd gotten to the hut, the Elizabeth Parker hut, where we were going to be spending the night. And he said, you know, in the morning, I'm going to make you guys a Canadian cuisine. I'm going to make you Canadian food because I've learned, you know, how to make it. And we're like, okay, sounds good. His attempt wound up being barely cooked bacon mixed in with rum and raisin, or like, yeah, basically it was like the old Quaker Oats that had the raisins in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was like an oatmeal raisin with like cinnamon or something. And he'd put the bacon, the barely cooked bacon, into the oatmeal. Huh. And we couldn't eat it. It was virtually inedible. And we were, but like, how do you do this? Because he's like looking at us with these like hopeful eyes, and you're just like, oh, Rajat, dude, like, this is not. But I mean, I would be loath to do something correct for the food he would eat too. Like, don't ever get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But like, his attempt really fell flat. And I remember we were all pretty hungry that morning because nobody wanted to touch the food that he'd put together. It was very funny.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution Class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper.
I think we can move on, unless there's anything else you want to say about just the alien food that's out there, and maybe get into more how food sort of defines a character, because I think that's another really big piece of this.
I will say, just recently, the Delta Flyers podcast, they're covering Deep Space Nine episodes, and they talked about the episode Cardassians, which, for those of you who don't remember, that's where there's a young Cardassian who's been raised by Bajorans because he was left behind during the occupation, and then it raises this whole thing about Cardassian orphans on Bajor and stuff. And there's this great scene, just speaking of food, where he's under the care of Keiko and Miles while this is all getting sorted out, and Keiko replicates a Cardassian dish Zabu stew or something like that, which he's actually never, ever had in his life. He's been raised by Bajorans. It's actually kind of tone deaf of Keiko to, he's like, here's something you're familiar with. And he's like, what are you talking about? And there's this great moment where O'Brien tries a piece of it and he's like, ugh. And he pushes his plate to the middle of the table at the same time this kid does. And they clank together and they look up and they kind of bond over their mutual dislike of Cardassian stuff. Which is just like, I think, emblematic of this use of food in Star Trek to tell stories, which I thought that was, but, you know, on a more basic level, this green stew that looks like maybe it had chunks of lime jello in it or something. I don't, it was like, looked very unappetizing. It was also kind of cream based somehow. I don't know. It looked very unappetizing.
Yeah. Unappetizing. Ugh. Well, using food to tell a story, maybe I'll kind of start with that. And I'll start with, it's a warrior's drink. Worf, of course, chooses prune juice as his, you know, weapon of choice when it comes to drinking things. And again, it kind of shows maybe a bit of a misunderstanding of human food. At the same time, you know, he's more Klingon than Klingon in a lot of ways. So that's always an amusing kind of bit of humor. But when Michael Dorn was doing photo ops at the replica of 10 Forward at one of the STLVs, I forget which one, I had purchased some prune juice at one of the convenience stores somewhere off the strip in Las Vegas, and had brought two plastic cups that I'd stolen from somewhere up to the 10 Forward. And I'm standing in line waiting, and I've got my little bag with me. And then all of a sudden I come out and I see everyone's ready. And there's sort of like a manager kind of telling us where to stand. And I'm like, well, can we get a little closer to the counter? And he's like, yes, of course. And then he looks and he's like, what's that bag? Because I think he started realizing what was about to happen. And I produce this bottle of prune juice, and I open up the prune juice and I pour it into both. And I've set these two cups on the table, the illuminated 10 Forward table. And I just, there's this silence that goes everywhere. And the guy says to me, the manager dude, he's like, if you spill that, I am going to kill you. And he's like, and I'm not kidding, I will actually kill you. And I remember Michael Dorn, a very, very tall man, looking down at me with this mischievous smile of like, oh, kid, what are you doing? I'm like, will you share some prune juice with me at 10 Forward? And he's like, all right. And so I have a picture of Michael Dorn and myself holding two cups of prune juice at 10 Forward. And Michael Dorn has this look of like, oh, I've seen it all kind of thing. And great. Yeah, I didn't spill a drop. I was very good. But I think I caused a collective heart attack among all the people who were planning that. And yeah, sometimes you just got to ask for forgiveness rather than permission, right?
Absolutely. It's funny, Worf's prune juice thing is something that I think like only he can pull off. Like, yeah, there's the joke aspect of it and stuff, but like, I remember when he first shows up on Deep Space Nine and he walks into the bar, and Quark's been dealing with Klingons for the last couple of weeks, right? And he's like, oh, let me guess, you want some blood wine? Prune juice. And Quark just like, prune juice. Yeah. Coming right up as Worf just like stares him down.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. He can pull it off. Yeah. Well, get the man some prune juice.
Absolutely. And you know what? To be able to hold your prune juice, I think actually is a feat, because I have eaten accidentally in my life when I was a younger man. I liked dried fruit, and I ate dried fruit from time to time, especially when I was hiking, and made the mistake of dicing some prunes into my trail mix. And much like my experience in Belize, I wasn't able to get very far that day, shall we say, because prunes really do get the trains running on time, let me put it that way. So if you are a warrior, you're able to hold your own after a big cup of prune juice, let me put it that way.
So yeah, like you said, a warrior's drink. And I like this note that you have here. Prune juice is to Worf as whiskey is to Scotty, and as Earl Grey is to Picard. These drinks that define the characters in a lot of ways that we are talking about here. Picard's tea Earl Grey hot just became so emblematic of that character. And a Frenchman?
And it's a warrior's drink.
Sort of, not really.
No. No, it's not for Frenchmen. But I do believe for Picard, he is a warrior. And that is his warrior's drink.
Mm-hmm. Scotty with his whiskey, he's even used it as a weapon against. So it really is a warrior's drink.
100%. But the one thing that we had talked about kind of before we hit record was the captains of the TNG era, especially. So that's Deep Space Nine and Voyager connected in there, is just how caffeine addled they all must be at any given point, right? There is a fair amount of caffeine in Earl Grey tea. Janeway literally is on the hunt for coffee pretty much all the time. And as we see, as the Dominion War goes, the prevalence of Ractigino really starts showing up around Deep Space Nine. So any thoughts on the over-caffeination of Janeway, Picard, and Sisko?
It's one of those things that, yeah, I feel like it starts out as a shorthand, you know, for a writer, right? Like, it's, first of all, it's something interesting. It's a prop they can hold. They, you know, actors like that sort of thing. But then it starts to become this, I don't want to say a crutch, because that has a negative kind of connotation to it in this sense. But it continues to be that shorthand for the character that, like, oh, this is a, you know, for Picard, Earl Grey tea, that seemed to kind of surround scenes of comfort and scenes where he's entertaining people or something like that, or it's a quiet evening kind of thing. Janeway, it was like a call to action, right? Coffee, black. And it was kind of her pre-war ritual almost. Like, it was putting her war paint on, was getting a cup of coffee. She's getting ready to go into battle. I would say almost the same with Sisko and his Ractigino. I think it really becomes how we see these characters and how we can kind of anticipate how they're going to respond to a situation or how they're going to move forward in whatever's going on.
I guess I can kind of relate. I am quite the coffee and tea drinker. In the mornings, I will always have two cups of coffee. And there have been times in the past where I've had four or five, and my acid reflux gets the better of me when I do stuff like that. Being in education, sometimes you do need to let the caffeine do the talking, especially when you're having a hard morning where you're not sleeping well enough. But one thing that I've really taken to, especially in the last couple of years, is I'll typically enjoy a cup of tea after my supper. Whenever I have a supper, I like tea, and then maybe going on a little walk with my dog, just to kind of help the digestion process. And much like the cup you gifted me, Dan, one time, that has a picture of Picard on it that says tea, Earl Grey hot. Never put that one through the dishwasher. If you do, you lose the image. So I've always hand washed that one with great care. It's one of my favorite cups. But I will enjoy Earl Grey tea or Lady Grey tea. And then sometimes I go off the beaten path of caffeine and we'll have just a nice peppermint tea or a chamomile tea as well. But tea factors really heavily. And I mean, having the fact that my grandfather got me into Star Trek as a young boy, he drank tea every day after his work also. So I think that's an important little connector that... I think one of the reasons why I drink so much tea definitely comes from the fact that my family pretty much is dredged up from the mud of the British Islands, Ireland and Great Britain. So there's that. And of course, they got that idea from the conquest of India and everything else. But outside of that, I do think that in a lot of cases, Star Trek did factor in quite a bit, because every time I have Earl Grey tea, obviously, I think in the back of my head, I'm saying tea, Earl Grey, hot.
I also... will note Tilly's addiction, I would say, to coffee and espresso, as we see in Discovery, so much so that the replicator has cut her off for health reasons on occasion.
Yes. Well, that is a total thing. There's a very funny YouTube video. Those of you who are interested in rock music, there's a band called Them Crooked Vultures, which is a super group. It's got a guy, Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin, and Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters and Nirvana. And it's called Fresh Pots. And it is Dave Grohl just wigging out. Pretty much it's just, as they're recording their album, Dave is just dancing around and being a silly person and, you know, freaking out and being hyper. And it's because he was drinking so much coffee, he actually had to go to the hospital at the end. And like they say, like, as much as this was all really funny, Dave Grohl did actually spend a certain amount of time, and he would shout fresh pots all the time, because he wanted his coffee to keep himself going. So it is true. Like, the key to life, folks, is moderation. If you like your coffee, don't overdo it. I'm also living proof of that, where more than three cups drops of coffee makes me feel sick now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we got to be careful.
Speaking of addiction, there's one thing I added to this section that I wanted to talk about a bit, because I think longtime listeners will know I love my Deep Space Nine. And, you know, the Star Trek hasn't done a ton with alcohol addiction or anything like that. There have been substance abuse allegories and that sort of thing. But I found Damar in the final season of Deep Space Nine. There was a really interesting character arc for him as he's, you know, deep within the Dominion war machine. He's the head of Cardassia that's basically under his watch become subjugated by the Dominion, supposedly allies, but really they're a subject world of the Dominion at this point. In order to cope with that, in order to get through the day, he's, you know, starting the day with a glass of Canard, continuing on until, you know, towards the end of this part of the arc, he's drinking it straight from the bottle. Like, he is not doing well. And it's the moment where he turns around and decides to start a resistance against the Dominion and to lead his people out from under the yoke of the Dominion. We get that great scene where he pours himself a glass, is about to raise it to his lips and sees himself in the mirror, and then throws the drink at the mirror. And it, this thick, syrupy canard, whatever it is, I think, actually, I remember them saying that it was basically a syrup, like very sweet syrup that was used as the prop. And they did so many takes and so many scenes where Damar had to drink this stuff that he actually passed out at one point from too much sugar.
Oh, goodness.
Which I think is very emblematic of how far gone the character of Damar had gone, where the actor Casey Biggs is feeling the effects of the prop they're using.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that scene, yeah, where he throws it at the mirror is just such a good scene and such a turning point for that character. And I think that's interesting when the food and drink becomes a character in and of itself, or a strong plot point that the lives of the characters kind of hinge on and turn on. I think that's really cool.
Well, and I think therein lies a certain level of what it takes to stand up for what is right, right? You can become, I guess, addicted to compliance and the easy way, right? What is an addiction but a means from which to sort of put aside or cope with some kind of hardship, right? It's a form of escapism. It's a way to kind of break yourself away from the things you really truly have to deal with. And yeah, I mean, the Damar arc at the end of Deep Space Nine was absolutely phenomenal. I really have to say it was something that has always I've held very close to my heart. And yeah, for Deep Space Nine to delve into something so scary as, you know, the concept of alcoholism, right? That's ultimately what it boils down to. I have to give Casey Biggs a lot of credit, sounding like he you're right, he sort of suffered like his character did, but that often makes it the best, doesn't it? And the fact that Deep Space Nine didn't pull any punches there, right? Him rising to that occasion does ultimately, and I guess, you know, decades old spoiler alert, right? It costs him his life, but instead of living like a slave, he dies a hero. And I think sometimes you have to look at it that way when you're overcoming different types of addictions, is certain aspects of you have to die for the rest of you to live. And I think, you know, anyone who might be going through addiction or fighting addiction, it is a massive feat to be able to get yourself into a position where you can overcome it. And you have to understand that it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a liberation struggle in a lot of ways, much like Casey Biggs's character felt. So good addition and good connection there. I mean, we can maybe argue that Scotty Montgomery Scott back in the day had some issues as well. Definitely would get blackout drunk and stuff like that, but it was kind of played more for comedy than it was actually for what Damar was going through. The last little piece that I want to talk about before we kind of get into some of our favorite chefs of Star Trek is Sluggo Cola, the most slimiest cola in the galaxy. Now with 43% live algae in every bottle. try a lukewarm glass of it today. I have to say the gross out factor, you know, try it with some bloodworms, I think is typically what the Ferengi would eat with that.
Mm.
I appreciate the idea that all of the heroic aspects of eating gross food that the Klingons end up sort of aspiring to is just instead kind of turned on its head by the Ferengi, who, you know, love their rainy, rainy planet. Every day is gloomy and awful, and that's what they look for. And their food, I have to say, I would try Gach before I'd try anything that a Ferengi would ever want to eat, though I do quite love them as a species.
What's one of the Ferengi rules of acquisition? I can't remember the number, obviously, but it's very emblematic of their food. It was, new customers are like saber-toothed gree worms. They can be succulent, but sometimes they bite back.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes they bite back. Ugh.
Also, I do have to say, Sluggo Cola, real staying power in Ferengi society, given that in the last season of Discovery, the Ferengi bartender on Discovery was serving Sluggo Cola, interestingly, again, to Tilly. So Tilly is someone who enjoys the occasional Sluggo Cola, much to Commander Rayner's disgust, which I thought was kind of funny.
And does Futurama do Sluggo as well? Is that a thing?
I think it's Slurm. I think is Slurm drink, yeah.
Right, but it really gave me a Sluggo kind of feel to it, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess like a really quick shout out that J.J. Abrams has indelibly added Slusho to the Star Trek universe. That's something that shows up in just like there's a specific character that he always adds to his stories as well. That Slusho is definitely a thing that shows up in the Star Trek universe now. So just a quick shout out there to the JJ verse and their Slusho. So I guess the last piece that I want to talk about, and this is kind of where it all came from, is Neelix and his Leola root heavy delicacy. He even has a Star Trek cookbook that he is the title on, and his Leola rice pilaf, I think was one of the really important ones that kind of comes up. But I often think about versatile food, and of course, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And I gotta say, the Leola root, I think, is kind of like the variant of durian, jackfruit. Those people who might have a more plant-based diet might be familiar with jackfruit. It's not as gross, I think, because I think a lot of people, when they try Leola root in Voyager, don't like it to taste it. But it can be quite versatile and can be used in different ways. Jackfruit is much the same. I've ended up having jackfruit jerky before that's quite like beef jerky. I've actually had jackfruit stir fry where I didn't know it was jackfruit that I was eating. I thought it was maybe a chicken or a pork or something like that. So it's a very interesting and versatile dish, and sort of a mad props to Neelix for always being very adventurous and resilient when it comes to making different types of food that you've got to kind of work with what you've got rather than what you want.
And also, I would say, resilient to the ribbing and abuse heaped on him by the Voyager crew for some of his cooking. I think a lot of people would have, you know, thrown up their hands and said, fine, whatever. I'm not going to help you save your replicator rations. To hell with all of you.
Well, exactly. Right. Okay, fine. If you don't want to eat, if you want to eat less, you know, at least you're eating something, and this all has the nutritional value that you need. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I ate pretty much plant-based for a number of years, just out of my own choice. And there were times I missed certain types of food and all that sort of stuff. And I still do kind of follow a certain level of dietary restriction even to this day. And there's food that I'd like to just have, but I've got to stick to my principles. And I think Neelix was very good at sticking to those principles. So there is, in fact, I found a Leola rice pilaf recipe that you can make. It's not necessarily, you're not going to have actual Leola root, but it sounds quite good. It's just very vegetable heavy, and if you know how to make a pilaf, then it'll be pretty easy for you.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, cooking for people is one of the greatest gifts that someone can give, right? And I remember growing up watching Voyager and not particularly liking the character of Neelix. like a lot of people, I guess, which I think is really unfair. And I think Neelix really is just, he's such a wholesome character when it comes down to it. And so giving of himself, and emblematic of that is his, you know, cooking for the Voyager crew. Like, that really is an act of love. Yes. And I think as I grow older, the more I come to appreciate that character and that aspect of that character as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, moving on to maybe some better cooks, and not necessarily to say that Neelix is a bad cook, but maybe, you know, when all of the pistons are firing, you know, you can't say no to Sisko's jambalaya, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to try that. Think it,
oh man, absolutely. Actually, you know what? Thanks to Deep Space Nine, I actually tried jambalaya. I realized at some point jambalaya. In my life that I'd never tried it. And there used to be a really good Cajun restaurant right in central Edmonton. It got torn down for an apartment complex a number of years. Obviously, this is in the early 2000s that it was torn down. But during the run of Deep Space Nine, as a young boy of 20-something, I realized I hadn't ever tried jambalaya before. And yeah, I went to this little Cajun restaurant and tried it for the first time. And again, much like my Belizean experience, it was very, very spicy going in. And I really enjoyed it. It was quite tasty. The amount of seafood in it, very, very healthy portions of that. Kind of a tomato-based jambalaya, I guess. There's different forms you can get, but the type I had was very tomato-based.
Nice. Well, yeah, Sisko, great cook, a family history of cooking. His mm-hmm. father has a gourmet restaurant in New Orleans, of course. But we also have, I think, an important cook for his crew, Pike. We have that feeling of family and camaraderie as he brings his crew together in that massive set of quarters he has with the industrial kitchen set up, basically. Yeah, some great scenes there and some great moments of the crew coming together as Pike cooks for them. Again, this act of love, right?
Well, and you touch on something really important, and I think that's maybe a through line we can make with Neelix, Sisko, and Pike, in the fact that, you know, Neelix makes his connection with the Voyager crew through his cooking for them. Pike does the same thing. He kind of takes on a bit of a space dad role in doing that. And I desperately want his kitchen. Actually, I would love to live in his quarters. His quarters are absolutely gorgeous, and I would live there happily. I don't know why Kirk chose such smaller quarters later, but anyway, I have to say, I think that connection you made with Sisko to his father, right? I do recall in certain episodes his father being critical of him when he was cooking. And I think there is a father-son love that is expressed through those family recipes and cooking for each other. And cooking, like in Sisko's cooking, especially, and his connection to his dad in that respect. So I think you're very much on the nose by stating the fact that when a character cooks for another set of characters, it's an act of love. And I think in real life, that's the thing too. You know, I haven't spoken to Rajat since he left and went back to India. I've never spoken to him ever again, actually, because we went hiking in the early 2000s, long before Facebooks and all those other things. So he's just really not around anymore. But I do feel very much like, though he didn't necessarily get it right, his desire to cook for us that morning was an act of love. It was an act of trying to make a connection with us and whatnot. And I mean, I am the primary cook for my family, not out of any kind of, you know, sense of anything but love. I love to cook, and I love to cook for people, and I love to find things that people like and cook those things for them, because it is important. It's good, and it's necessary. And something important, I think, about breaking bread with other human beings, I think, is very important. We are very much a food-driven species. We have extremely sophisticated flavor palates compared to other animals who smell or see or hear better. A human being can taste poison a lot more easily than a lot of other animals. So I do think that for that reason, food does factor into our social structure quite well.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. And I think in Star Trek in particular, there's a lot of occasions where coming together for that meal in a lot of different situations can mean a lot of different things. So earlier I mentioned Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, that infamous dinner that goes badly with the dyed blue lobster pieces that were apparently not so good after sitting under studio lights for a couple hours. The less said about the aftermath of that, the better, apparently. William Shatner being one of the few people who actually ate some is from what people have said anyway. But that whole scene, right, the coming together of these historic adversaries, and it not necessarily ending well, but this first step, right? The idea that, like, hey, let's try that. Let's try breaking bread together. Let's try having food together to see if that can spark this alliance, which eventually they become, you know, allies and all of that stuff. But there's so many times in Star Trek where meals and bringing people together is an important plot point. The dinner table is such an important place in our lives. It makes sense that even hundreds of years in the future, that would still be that symbol of camaraderie or family or friendship. Or, you know, like I said, that scene between O'Brien and that Cardassian boy, you know, it's a shared experience over a meal, in that case the disgust of it, kind of thing.
And yeah, we do touch into something important, and again, it's that realization that Star Trek isn't actually human beings exploring the stars. It's actually us exploring the inner sense of what it means to be human, and food is such a huge aspect. So for the Picards and their Earl Grey tea and the prune juice and the sluggo and everything, I think we can see how Star Trek explores humanity through the food we eat and the food that aliens eat as reflections and extensions of the human condition. Their food also will reflect that humanity and what makes us us in such a fundamental way. So I think this is a good place to sort of close the discussion at this point. You know, I'm always interested to hear about people's favorite foods and trying different types of food. Please be sure to share if you do have a type of food that you enjoy, and what your favorite is and why. I'm always looking for new recipes too. So yes, and Dan, I'm going to hold you to that we should go to that Korean restaurant and try all of the tasty treats there.
Absolutely. I am there.
Well, with that, we thank you all for listening. We hope everyone's hungry now. Go out and eat the food you love most, and stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! ¡Gracias! Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.